Welcome to the Game Mystery Podcast, featuring interviews with some of the most renowned authors and up-and-coming talent in LGBTQ mysteries, suspense, and thrillers. I'm your host, Brad Shreve, and Justine Adamick is here with her weekly recommendation. Okay, Justine, I'm really excited about your review this week because it is a profound moment in LGBT mystery events that have happened. And I know it's Marshall Thornton, and you're going to talk about his finale of Nick
Nowak. I'm going to talk about the Boys Town 13 book, which ends the series. I didn't read it right when it first came out because I didn't want the series to end, but I couldn't resist any longer. It's called Fade Out. The title is an homage to the first David Brandstetter book by Joseph Hansen, which was also called Fade Out.
And I got to say, you're not the only one. A lot of people put off reading this book because they didn't want it to end.
Yeah. And I got to say, I keep hoping that he's going to come up with the book with these characters, that he's going to continue the series at some point. But this ends the arc and ends a lot of the storylines and ties them up. It starts out with Nick finally finding his HIV status. And it's set in a time when there was still no cure. In this book, it is when Rock Hudson is dying in a Paris hospital of AIDS. And they're giving him experimental drugs, which are still at least a year away from the market. So at this point, HIV is still a death sentence. Mm. Got Ross still living in his apartment, and he's got his boyfriend Joseph, and those relationships, they don't come to an end necessarily. They come to some sort of plateau. Along with that, he's tied up the crime family, and there's an appearance by Owen Lovejoy, who is the attorney who used to give him a lot of work, who did him wrong somewhere along the way. Sugar Peelson, his socialite friend, pops up. And above this is a mystery. And there's a single mystery that he's chasing down. It involves very mundane things. Who's stealing money out of dormant bank accounts? And it ends up twisting into something that gets it a thrilling recommendation.
Thrilling.
And as all things, this has, you know, throughout the book, he comes to realizations. And throughout the book, some things come to an end and other things begin. And this book is no different. Although at the end, you're never quite sure, you know, at the end, when things are beginning, you don't have any hint of where they're going to go. And that's why it stayed out.
Okay. So we're going to give it a thrilling and how about a grieving recommendation?
Yeah.
I don't know if that's a recommendation.
I think that my tone is very mournful. I love this book. I'm going to be sad to see Nick go.
You and many others.
Yes. So by the way, last week when I was talking about the Dal McLain book, used the word convoluted. And I think I've used that word in the past. And not everybody sees it as a benefit as I do. The convoluted mysteries are my absolute favorite kind of mysteries. I don't find them confusing. If it was so convoluted I couldn't make heads or tails of it, then I would not give it a 5-star recommendation. I like convoluted. That's what most intriguing mysteries come up with. Every now and then, the intriguing mysteries are kind of locked puzzle kind of rooms or locked room puzzles. But a convoluted mystery, it's a lot of twists and turns and layers on top of each other, and it builds outward, and then you get the entire picture at the end. And I really like convoluted.
Good clarification. That makes sense. So, again, a reminder, if you're being reviewed by Justine, it means you're doing something right.
Yes. Many of these books that I come across end up being some of my favorite books. I've gotten some in through the request that I have just loved and read everything else by the author immediately.
And if anyone would like Justine to review their book, even if it's convoluted,
Especially if it's convoluted.
Especially if it's convoluted. It's info@gamemysterypodcast.com. Send it over in a Mobi file, and we'll make sure Justine gets it, and we'll look at the book, and maybe we can get you on the air.
Sounds great.
All right, Justine. Well, thank you. Sit back and enjoy the interview. All right, see you then. If you enjoy Gay Mystery Podcast, let others know by leaving a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to our show. Mark McNeice, my guest today, is the author of 9 novels, 6 produced plays, and dozens of short stories. 2 of his Kyle Callahan mysteries were bestsellers on Kindle in the LGBT mystery genre, and his short story, Stop the Car, was selected for Kindle Singles Program. He won an Emmy and a Telly as a co-creator and writer for children's program Into the Outdoors. He's the host of One Thing or Another podcast, and he currently lives with his husband and 2 cats in rural New Jersey. Hello, Mark. It is an honor to have you on the show today.
Thanks, Brad, and thanks for throwing that in there, the honor part. That was nice. I don't know why, but I'm glad you said it.
Well, it is an honor because I need to thank you. You are my hero. It is because of you. And I don't know if I told you when I was on your podcast. It is because of you that this podcast exists.
And you mentioned that. Yeah, you mentioned that you had read, I'm going to guess it was Murder at Pride Lodge, one of those.
Exactly. That was your first Kyle Callahan mystery. Was that also your first full-length novel?
It was. Yeah, okay. And I learned from that experience, by the way. So,
well, I got to tell you, it was the very first gay mystery I ever read. I stumbled on it. I don't know how I found it. And I knew I wanted to be a writer, and I read that novel, and I'm like, wow, I've never read anything like this before, because all I'd ever read before were literary works, and which I didn't have that much interest in. And I read it, and I said, wow, I can write something. Unfortunately, after reading your novel, I kind of went on the wrong path and found 2 publishers that deal mostly with male fiction. Mm-hmm. And I thought, okay, you were an oddity. Obviously, that's what I have to write if I want to be a successful writer. And it wasn't my niche, and I was miserable. So I fortunately stumbled on Marshall Thornton and some other writers and realized that you weren't the only one out there. And but you were the beginning. I always remembered that Kyle Callahan mystery. And so I want to thank you again. You were the start of all of this.
Well, thank you. That makes me feel good, you know, because, I'm sure we'll talk about it as we're going along here. But you mentioned the MM romance, the MM mystery, and things seem to have changed a little bit the last 8 years. But I'm glad that I influenced or affected somebody.
Well, you certainly did. While we're talking about Kyle, before we get to your current story, anything in the future for Kyle?
I am halfway through the next Kyle Callahan mystery, and I'm trying to finish it. What happened was my husband and I moved to rural New Jersey from New York City, and I like to write about where I live. So interestingly, all of my characters from my various books and series all happened to somehow ended up moving to Lambertville, New Jersey, except Marshall James, who we'll talk about later. He's still in New York City because he's too old to change. But I'm halfway through the next book. It's been 4 years since the last one. And I wasn't sure if there was going to be another one, but I wanted to end it. Whether there's one beyond this or not, I don't know. But I wanted to wrap it up for this Kyle and Danny. It's an older couple, now they're about 60. They're the same age as me and my husband Frank. So yes, there is another one. I hope. It's just I'm a slow writer. It could be 6 months. It could be a year.
So you tend to write about older characters.
I do because I'm comfortable with them. And what happened was how that book, Murder at Pride Lodge, it came about because I've been writing since I was a child. I've been, which is, you know, so I'm looking at having written in one way or another for over 50 years. And I wrote poetry for 10 years. I wrote plays that were produced. And Frank and I go to a resort called Rainbow Mountain in the Poconos. We love it there. It's a LGBTQ resort that's been there for probably almost 30 years. And one day I was taking pictures and they had an empty swimming pool. And I took this beautiful picture of this empty blue pool and something struck me. And I said to Frank, this would be a great place to set a murder mystery. And that's what I did. I moved it to New Hope, Pennsylvania. It's actually in East Stroudsburg. I told them that I was doing this, by the way, the resort, so that they would be okay with it. And they were fine. I did a reading there. It went great. But I wanted to write a book about with older characters. And I wanted to write a murder mystery. I'd never done it before. And I thought, if I sell a few, I'll write a second one. And then I ended up writing five of them.
And you're doing just fine.
I am doing fine. I'm doing fine because I love to do it. Now, I've always had a regular job. Mm-hmm. I don't keep a roof over my head writing gay mysteries. Very few people do. But I love doing it, and I like writing about characters that are like me. They're older characters, because that's my life, you know? I do write younger characters. I just wrote a supernatural thriller, which is not gay, and it features a young couple. So I can write about young couples, and I can write about straight people, too. But, you know, this is just something that I did, and I love doing it. So I've done, you know, half a dozen of them more.
And Marshall James, we talk about his younger years.
Yes. That's I'm just finished the second book. There's really only going to be three. My plan is only to have three, but it's a man named Marshall James, which is a reversal of my birth name. I'm adopted, and my name is Mark McNeese, of course, but when I was born, my name was James Marshall Green. And so I took James Marshall and flipped it around and Marshall James. But he's now nearing 60, and he lives in New York City, where I lived when I created him. And he's a cancer survivor, and he decides that, you know, maybe he'll survive, maybe he'll spend the rest of his life without cancer, maybe it will come back. But it's time to talk about these murders that he was involved with in Los Angeles in the 1980s. He did not commit them. I don't think that would be a very good protagonist unless it's in self-defense.
Yeah.
So the first book is Murder at the Paisley Parrot, where he worked as a bartender at a bar called the Paisley Parrot. There was modeled after a real bar called the Lemon Twist. The book is dedicated to the Lemon Twist. It says, make mine a double. It was like a drunk's bar, and that was my kind of bar. Mm-hmm. I loved, because I was a heavy drinker. And I loved going to bars where you were there to drink. You weren't there to, you know, necessarily cruise or any of that shit. You were there to get blastered. Yeah. And some murders murders happen there. The mob's involved and all that stuff. And the second book is him a year later. He's involved with the detective, Mac McElroy, who was investigated the murder. And some other stuff happened, and there's a murder and, you know, all of that stuff. So I don't want to just keep talking. I don't want to step on your.
Well, no, I was going to ask you about James Marshall and tell people who he is. So you just did a great job of doing that. Do want to let them know, you said the first book was Murder at the Paisley Parrot. And your upcoming novel is Beautiful Corpse, which is the second Marshall James thriller. Go ahead.
Oh, no, I thought you might have a question about it.
I was going to say, do you have a release date for that yet?
I'm going to aim for April. Now, what I do is my husband reads everything I write. He's my number one beta reader. I have had others, but Frank reads everything. And he's can take his time. So it might take him 3 or 4 weeks to read one of my manuscripts, and he just finished reading it. So the next few days we're going to go over his notes and questions. And then I would do another draft. I don't know if I need to change anything or not. I'm waiting to get feedback. And then of course it gets proofread. Mm-hmm. I've used a paid proofreader in the past, because no matter how many times we look at a manuscript, we're going to miss something. So I think I'm really want to get it out in April. I just don't know if it's going to be early April or late April.
But we're shooting for April.
Yeah.
The Beautiful Corpse, the second Marshall James thriller. And you sent me a copy, a rough copy that you have. And I want to tell you, I didn't read it. because I chose to read Murder at the Paisley Parrot instead.
Oh, good.
And I got to tell you, my bipolar brain, I read very slowly, and sometimes it's hard for me to finish a novel. I couldn't put it down.
Oh, thank you.
Because I love Marshall James. It's gritty. It's cynical. He's a lot of fun. I relate a lot to the story because it takes place in Hollywood. I didn't live in Hollywood in 1983, but I do live in LA now. And it just resonated with me. So I'm looking forward to Beautiful Corpses. You know, I can't read every book for every guest that's on the show.
Of course,
I just don't have the time. But I try to at least read part of the book or get an understanding of the book. But yours, I said, I'll pick it up and take a look at it. And I was sucked in.
Thank you. And by the way, Justine had given it a really good review, too.
Yes, she did.
Yeah. And that really excited me. You know,
well, I don't know when the last time you were in Los Angeles was, but I got to tell you, even though Hollywood has changed, it hasn't changed. Hollywood Highland is this beautiful, you know, center where they hold the Oscars and where the Chinese theater is. And then down in Hollywood and Vine is developed. But in between the two, it's still very sketchy. And it's not as gritty as it was, but it's still gritty, especially on the side streets.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I was able to relate to the book so much.
Well, thank you. And one thing that I enjoy so much about writing that particular series is getting to go back and remember the French Market, which is out of business, the Hollywood Spa, which was there for almost 30 years, the mm-hmm. bathhouse. That's in the book. That's gone now too, but just sort of have those things come back to life in my mind.
I did drive by the French Market yesterday, as a matter of fact, and it's still boarded up.
So
sad to see that go. So, and that's a restaurant that Mark refers to in the novel that was very popular with the gay crowd, especially for me. It was the after bar crowd.
Yeah, and there was a little place in there called Dorothy's Surrender.
Yeah,
it was a card shop, and I remember sitting in the French Market having fried zucchini sticks. And I'm of an age, and you are too, where a lot of the people are gone. A lot of those young men that I was with and they died, you know, mm-hmm. during the AIDS years. So LA was kind of a ghost town. It's a really big reason why I moved to New York when I had the chance, because that was 1993. There was just everywhere I went, I could remember being there with someone who had passed away, and I wanted out. So the opportunity came to move to New York, and that's what I did.
You know, I wasn't out during that time period. I was in the closet, North Carolina. So I was very shielded. You know, AIDS was this thing that was happening elsewhere, even though I only knew one person that developed AIDS at that time. And so I really appreciate books like yours and some others that go back and talk about that period, because I get a really understanding and very sad feeling of what was going on and an understanding of what was going on. You painted a very good picture of that very well without dragging us into it, I guess I should say. It just was.
Yeah, it was just life. So like you said, it's not an AIDS memoir, but that's when you're a gay man living, you know, in LA and Hollywood in 1984, this is life.
You have to mention it, yes. Yeah. So definitely. Now, you won an Emmy for a children's program. So first of all, I want to say great job, not congratulations, because you obviously worked hard for it.
Thank you.
Tell us about that. How did you become involved in children's programming?
Well, I was going to say, I think when I in the bio that I sent you, I don't think I didn't mention Sesame Street. I worked at Sesame Street for 8 years. It was my first job in New York. I was an assistant to the producer in the international department. And I just talked to her again after almost, I'm going to say 20 years, Natasha Lance. She produced the shows in Mexico and Russia, because what we would do at Sesame Street, they were co-productions. So the country would create their own show, their own puppets, their own curriculum, all of that stuff, and we would train them how to do it. So I worked in that department for 8 years. I became the story editor for the co-production. So I would read all of the scripts and deal with that end of it. But what happened was I left there, and my friend Rick Rose, who I've been friends with for 30 years now and still collaborate with on many things, he moved back to Wisconsin. His family has a production company, and they wanted to make a children's TV show. They have a show called Discover Wisconsin, a travel program that's been on for, I'm going to say 30 years, but they wanted to create a children's program specifically to excite and educate kids about the outdoors, because that's really big in Wisconsin. And they got funding, and they Rick called me and he said, you want to help me co-create the show? And I said, sure. So 20 years ago, we created the show. It's called Into the Outdoors. They've been on for 20 years. I wrote it for the first 2 years because originally we had two kids characters that we created. They're not part of that show anymore. But I wrote it for 2 years and we got an Emmy the first year. And it was so funny because I didn't go to the ceremony because we were up against Bozo the Clown in his retirement year. And I thought, there's no way in hell we're going to take an Emmy when it's Bozo's retirement year.
Damn Bozo.
And we won. We won. So Rick, he texted me. He went. I don't think he went either. And he's like, oh my God, we won. I said, oh shit. Because it meant that this person that I was not fond of, who was a producer, got to get up and accept it. And I thought, well, Mark, there you go. That's what you get for not going.
Now, when did you first develop your interest in writing?
When I was a little kid, you know, here's a sort of emoji teardrop moment. I was a queer kid and I knew it. I mean, I knew that I liked boys and I knew that I was really curious and I had this mind that wanted to know, like, why is this that way and all this stuff. And I started writing was an escape. Writing and reading. I grew up in a house without books. My parents didn't read. My dad was the most incurious person I've ever met. But my sister, my big sister Kathy, and I loved to read. So I read voraciously as a kid. I was reading at a college level in the seventh grade. And when I was young, I was reading Poe. I credit Edgar Allan Poe for my vocabulary. Because I would mark out, highlight words, or, you know, like Poe just used language. He didn't write down to anybody. Mm-hmm. And so I was constantly encountering these words. I didn't know what they meant. So I would go and look them up in the dictionary. And I started writing stories probably when I was 10, just little short stories. And then that was it. I've been writing all these years. But I think I mentioned it went through phases. I wrote poetry for 10 years. And that's all I wrote when I was in high school. Anne Sexton, Sylvia Plath, Nikki Giovanni. One thing I've always said, a thought for other aspiring writers, is that if you want to develop an ear, read poetry. Read a lot of poetry. Maybe you hate poetry. I don't know. But it will help you learn how to use words in a very succinct way and how to shape sentences. So I think poetry is a real big tool, and it was a big part of my life. And I started writing fiction maybe after high school and just kept going, writing short stories and plays. And that's the long. Sorry.
I had another guest on the show that said the same thing, and I think I know who it was, but I don't want to name names because I'm not positive, but they said that poetry makes you learn to read, write concise.
It also helps. I can't remember if it was Tennessee Williams. I've never forgotten. The sentence was, dialogue is the illusion of conversation. And I've never forgotten that, because not everybody can write good dialogue, but part of learning how to write dialogue or to relax into it is knowing that it's an illusion. You know, dialogue is not how people really talk. If we write how people really talk, you're not going to want to read it.
No, it's very boring.
Yeah, so it's an illusion, and that's just another little thing for me that I've always remembered. You know, I'm not trying to write like the people that at the table next to me at the diner. I'm writing, you know, filtering it through poetry and sound, you know.
And so you've written poetry. You've done some screenplays. You won an Emmy for writing a children's show. Mm-hmm. How did all that take you to writing gay mysteries? What was your path?
I'm going to say, like I mentioned, we were at the Rainbow Mountain.
Yeah, that was the inspiration?
It was. I thought, what a great place to set a murder mystery. And I was I've been a fan of mysteries for years. One of my favorite, I just was talking to somebody the other day about P.D. James, the great, truly great British mystery writer. She's passed away, but I've always loved that. I was a big fan of Murder, She Wrote. I mean, I'll be honest, you know. And I just said, I'm going to write a mystery and I'm going to write a gay mystery because it made sense to me to write a gay mystery because it was about a gay resort.
Now, aside from your writing, you have a couple other passions that I'm aware of. First is podcasting.
Yeah.
You currently host One Thing or Another podcast.
I do. I started out about 8 years ago. It was all part of the whole, there was just that time in my life. I wrote the Murder at Pride Lodge and I started the LGBTSR. It's LGBT senior, but it's LGBTSR.com website. And what I did was I had a podcast with it called Age to Perfection. And my co-host was Rick Rose. And we did that for a couple years. And I've just always liked talking to people. And then I did a co-hosted one with him called The Twist for about a year and a half or so. And then I always wanted to just do one. It's just me interviewing people, talking to people like you. And now my tagline is interesting people doing interesting things. So it's a podcast. I've only got about 12 of them, 13 of them. But this year I'm going to really focus on that as well as reviving the LGBT senior website. And I've got Sue Katz, an author and activist, lined up. And because I don't want to just talk to authors. I've interviewed a lot of authors. I have nothing against them. And I know quite Marshall Thornton. I know a lot of folks, Michael Kraft. But I wanted to also talk to people who are like, maybe like, what's it like to run a cheese shop? I don't know. What's that about? So that's really what the podcast is, One Thing or Another. It's also a column. That's where the title came from on the website. It's One Thing or Another. I've been writing this column for the last few years, sporadically. But the podcast is like the podcast version of it.
Now, and as far as your LGBTSR newsletter, LGBT Senior, I did enjoy that when it was running for a while. So I'm glad you are bringing that back as well. What kind of information do you provide in the newsletter?
Well, it's the newsletter is the weekly content from the website. So what I've been doing from the beginning, I'll have columns on there. Like there's the Savvy Senior, which is syndicated. It's not mine. It's Jim Miller writes it, but that's on there every week. And he writes. I've always really liked the stuff he puts out. Like the one this week was on documents that seniors need, living wills, and next week is I'm losing it now. But hearing aids, just everything. He's nationally syndicated, and he's a really great guy. It doesn't cost me much at all. And then Terry Schlickenmeyer, who does book reviews, she's also syndicated. Because I'm like you, I can't read. I'm a very slow reader now. I used to read books like a lot. I would go to bed reading books. I don't do that anymore. So it takes me a long time to read a book. So Terry does, I get their book reviews from her. And then health information, weekly red lines, which is a headlines roundup. And I'm expanding it because, like I said, I'm reviving it. I just did, but while I was waiting to do the podcast with you, it's called Being Well with LGBTSR, and this one's on sleep apnea. So every week I'm going to find health topics that to write about. Podcast pick. I'm going to make this a podcast, not this with interview with me, but gay mystery podcast is going to be a podcast pick. So I'm exploring all of the things that I think that readers of the site would enjoy or find helpful. I learned a long time ago from doing it. There are a lot of us, a lot of LGBT seniors out there, outside of the metropolitan areas. And it meant so much to me to occasionally get an email from somebody saying, I live in, you know, Arkansas, and there's no gay center here. And thank you so much for what you're doing. That's really why I do it. I did get invited to the White House because of it, by the way, five years ago. During an administration where such a thing was possible. it was the LGBT Elder Housing Summit in the Obama White House. It wasn't in the White House. It was in the Eisenhower Building. But that was a huge high point for me to be invited to that. And then I also did a panel at the National Gay and Lesbian Journalists Association with the late Stephanie Mott. She passed away last year. She was a contributor, by the way. And then I don't want to take up too much time, but I had regular contributors. I had Stephanie Mott, a transgender woman who's not with us anymore. That broke my heart. David Webb out in Texas. He was wrote for the Gay Dallas paper for a long time. So, you know, when I can find contributors, I will. Otherwise, I'm just going to try to keep it interesting. And the email goes out every Thursday. You know, anyone can subscribe to it at lgbtsr.com or just go to the site and see what's there, you know.
I've got more questions, but we're going to take a pause to spin the wheel for awkward questions authors get.
Okay.
And what I do is I spin the wheel and we come up with a question and I toss it out at you. And these are usually questions we get, but sometimes they're a little hard to either hard to answer or take us aback, or sometimes we just don't like them. Okay. So give me a moment here while I spin the wheel. Okay, Mark, I have a question for you. I don't think this has come up before. Are you as socially inept as all writers?
That's funny. That assumes that writers are socially inept. What I am is not very sociable. So I guess the answer is yes. Now, if you saw me at work at the grocery store where I work, you might think I'm a really friendly guy. But my husband is the social person. He's like talks to everybody. He knows all our neighbors out here. And I'm not like that. So I don't know that I'm inept, but I'm definitely not. I'd like to, it worked. I recently, the other day, I said, I'm not a people person. That's why I like working in carryout as opposed to the deli counter where you have to interact with people all day long. I don't want to interact with people. I love to be alone at my computer, you know, maybe dinner with friends. My social circle has always been very small. So yes, I am.
Well, see, that surprised me. Based on your Facebook posts, where you post quite frequently things that you're out and doing, I would have thought you were very sociable.
Well, that's because it's Facebook. We go out a lot. You know, Frank and I, well, we also live in the woods where it's very rural here. We go out a lot, but not in groups. We're not going other than the seniors group that we belong to. And he belongs to the hiking club and all this stuff, like I said. So my life is pretty much I write, I work 4 days a week. We go out to dinner and stuff like that. And then once in a while, I'm with groups of people, but very rarely.
You work full time. You have a successful mystery series, a couple of them. You run a podcast. You have your newsletter. How in the hell do you manage your time?
I get up extremely early. I get up. That's why I was happy with the time change, because now instead of it being 4 o'clock, it's 5, which makes me feel like, oh my gosh, I slept till 5 o'clock. How nice. I get up early. I've been doing it for decades because I have always had a regular job. I've never been able to, even though I used to fantasize supporting myself as a writer. I did for 1 year. I think I was able to do it when I was writing the TV stuff. So I've always had to get up early because that's when I create. I can't come home and write. It just doesn't work for me. It never has. I have to be alone. My mind has to be fresh. And so I will get up at 5:30 in the morning and go to my computer and spend easily 2 hours a day at my computer. If it's a day off, it could be 3, 4, 5 hours. So I do that pretty much every day. And the work, fortunately, I only work, 4 days a week. It's full time, but I only work 32 hours. Mm-hmm. So I have 3+ days off every week, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and then I work Thursday nights. I mean, that's how I do it. Well, it's just sitting at my computer for 3 hours.
I am a morning person, meaning I bound out of bed and I'm singing songs, but not at 4 and 5 in the morning. So
the 4 o'clock thing is really my cat, Wilma. She won't let me sleep past then. I don't know how the cats know what time it is. I really don't. But she starts meowing at 4 and I can't sleep through it. Frank, he doesn't seem to even notice it, but it's like a baby's cry. I can't sleep through it. So I'll get up and feed her. Usually I'll go back and lay down for another 45 minutes or so. But I'm happy to get up at 5. I definitely am okay getting up at 5.
Well, I'm a cat lover and used to have cats, and they definitely love to get you up in the morning. They do know what time it is. I don't know how that is. Unfortunately, my husband is allergic to cats, so no cats in my life in the future. But,
oh, okay.
But that's okay. He's better than a cat anyway. So my final, I wanted you to prognosticate here a little bit. From your perspective, what does the future hold for the gay mystery genre?
Oh my golly. It's changed.
Yeah, you mentioned the change you mentioned male earlier.
Well, here's the thing. When I started it, and it wasn't that long ago, we're talking 8 years ago. When I had, like, say I had the first three books out, when you would go to Amazon and type in gay mystery, my books would come up.
Mm-hmm.
Not because they were bestsellers, but because the rest of the world hadn't caught on yet, is where I'm going with this. So you would type in gay mystery and you would see Murder at Pride Lodge or Pride and Perilous. And then what I saw, and I'm not that well versed in all of this because I don't read MM romance, but what I saw, I know that the MM romance genre was invented or created really by straight women for straight women. So I stay out of that.
Mm-hmm.
But I saw a colonization happening where they would throw in a murder, you know, throw in a dead body, and call it a gay mystery. And so when you went into Amazon, you type in gay mystery, now you'll see Marshall Thornton and Michael Nava and people like that, but you'll all see just a whole bunch of so-called gay mysteries written by straight women. Now, this is a conversation that, you know, a lot of people don't want to have. It's like I consider it a certain appropriation to a point, mm-hmm. you know, like appropriating the lives of gay men. And apparently that's okay. Like I said, I really stay out of it or try to, but, that's a big change that I saw. And it doesn't discourage me, but it sometimes makes me think I should just write Maggie Dahl mysteries. I should write supernatural thrillers with a straight young couple, because I'm not sure what my place is in gay mysteries today, because so many of them really aren't. They're not written by gay men, a lot of them. And I'm, you know, I don't know what the future of it holds.
Well, I got to say, I think your place is right where you are, because we need you. We need you there. It is there. A lot of it is written by women, and I've had many of the women on the show, and they're fine, because I do have a rule on this show that crime is prime, that, romance and sex are perfectly fine. There can be lots of fucking going on and, you know, lots of lovey dovey stuff going on, but the crime has to be the primary story. And there's a big difference between that and what we see categories as mystery, in which those are the ones that are really male-male romance that happens to have a chapter or a paragraph in the beginning and a paragraph at the end that mentions there's a murder, and then it's wrapped up at the end. And those are the ones that frustrate me, because books like yours and books like mine get lost in those when I don't consider those truly mysteries. But again, it's a touchy subject. A lot of people choose not to talk about it, and the ones that do sometimes regret it. So, but there you have it.
That's well, I do want to say that I think that there's room for everybody. I certainly don't hesitate to write a straight mystery, you know?
Right.
What was I going to say? I just think it's, you know, it is what it is. I don't think this would be happening with lesbian mysteries. I don't think you're ever going to find a bunch of straight women or straight men writing lesbian mysteries. There's something about the MM, you know, there's just something about it. But there's room for everybody. And I do know that when you go on, cause I've done it, when you go on into Amazon and type in gay mysteries or LGBT mysteries, you see plenty of us, you see plenty of us. So it's fine. And of course, Josh Lanyon, sort of blazed a trail with that.
Yes, she did.
So,
yeah. And again, I agree with you. I have no issue with MM mystery or MM stories at all. It's just there's a real blur of the line sometimes, and sometimes it's hard for me to make a judgment call on the show. But so there are gray areas, but that's okay.
Yeah.
Well, Mark, it has been indeed a pleasure to have you on. As I said, thank you. It's an honor for me. And thank you for getting me on my path.
Brad, thank you. And thank you for letting me in this, knowing that I've got to finish that Kyle Callahan mystery.
Yes, you do.
I've got to finish it.
Yes, you do.
Okay.
All right. Well, thank you again.
Thank you. And I look forward to it, to hearing it.
Hit the subscribe button wherever you hear our show so you don't miss a single episode. Tell a friend too. Thank you for listening.